Thanks, Brother Michael, and good evening, my dearly loved brethren and sisters. You should have with you, from the last class, a growing list of characteristics that we were trying to compile, and a couple of people actually talked to me about that after the last class, and it was quite an extensive list emerging. So if you've got it there, just get it out and keep going, because we're going to pull that together shortly and just have a look at what the characteristics that we're being told about in Dave that emerge out of the record so far from the time that Saul had lost his life on Mount Gilboa. Well, that's just picking up the threads and moving on. We're going to go back to chapter 3, to partway through chapter 3, and just quickly move across to chapter 5 where and surrounding chapter 5, where we're going to spend most of our time tonight. But we saw last in our last class the amazing set of providential circumstances and events that occurred following the death of Saul. Certainly not what probably most of us would have expected, because David had been promised to be king, and though he had spent 13 years in the wilderness being hunted by Saul, now Saul's taken out of the way, and all the events immediately seem to go against him. It's not a clear passageway through to the throne for David, and he didn't presume to think that he was going to be immediately made king. He was incredibly patient and sought God at every turn, and God eventually brought him to that position in time. But at the early part of that period, there was great tragedy in the nation, with civil war beginning and. As I say, things began to look as though they were completely contradictory to David and to the promise that God had made to him. But we know that the event that really hinged, that spun everything around, remarkably had nothing to do with a godly act anywhere to bring David to the kingdom. It was Abner's attempt at the throne himself by trying to take the throne over all Israel from Ish-bosheth. And Ish-bosheth caught him out, and he said, well, if you're going to deal with me like this, I'm going to go and bring the kingdom to David, just like Yahweh had said. So he knew all about it. Abner was a wily, wily politician, as we considered last time. And we find that he immediately swung right around and made overtures to David. And let's pick up the story where we left it off in chapter 3. Because Abner comes to David, and remarkably, David actually accepts the personage of this man as a brother. Now, this man, Abner, had chased David and had been responsible for the division and the persistent division in the nation for years and years, and had made David's life a misery as he'd been hunted by Saul, constantly talking in Saul's ear about this enemy David and how he had to be gotten rid of. And now David is confronted by Abner coming to him wanting to bring all the rest of Israel. And remarkably, David's attitude is just astounding. How he could just put away the past in his mind and accept this man as a brother and deal with him. And we find that after he'd spoken to Abner peaceably and his servants, he says in the end of verse 21 that David sent Abner away and he went in peace. You know, David was one of those men who had always wanted unity. And though the years had rolled on since God had promised him to be king, and the years had even rolled on after Saul's death, yet he'd found no peace. But he was essentially a man of peace, and while others had tried to make division, when the opportunity came, he buried past differences, he buried the attitudes of other men, didn't hold them against them, and moved forward. It's just a remarkable man. No wonder he's called a man after God's own heart, because we find him prefiguring the Messiah himself in terms of his own attitudes. And then we find in verse 22 that, behold, the servants of David and Joab came from pursuing a troop, and And they brought great spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away and he was gone in peace. Notice this, this little phrase, in peace, occurs several times here. Verse 21, verse 22. And when Joab and all the host that was with him, verse 23, were come, they told Joab, saying, Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he sent him away, and he's gone in peace again. So this is actually a remarkable thing that's being highlighted, the fact that David could deal with this man in this way. And Joab definitely was not of the same ilk. He couldn't deal with this. He was furious with David. And he castigates David for actually accepting him. He says to David, you've been hoodwinked by this man. Don't you know what's in his heart? He's got another agenda. And Joab storms out. And then we find in verse 26, when Joab was come out from David, he sent messengers after to Abner, which brought him again from the well of Sirah, but David knew it not. I don't think there's any doubt, brothers and sisters, that Joab had sent messengers in David's name, not in his name. Joab's name would never have been mentioned by those messengers. They'd said, because he'd seen that this had all been peaceable, and it was something that Joab was not going to accept. He was not a man of peace. He was not a spiritually minded man at all. He did not actually see that the unity of the nation was going to come through the godly spirit of a man after God's own heart. He was not on the same wavelength as David at all. And so he takes things into his own hands. And verse 27 tells us that Abner came back. He returned to Hebron. Presumably he'd been buoyed up by the reception that he'd had from David. And Joab took him aside in verse 27 in the gate to speak with him. In the gate of Hebron. You know, Hebron was one of the cities of refuge. And there, right in the gate of the city of refuge, Joab takes him aside to speak to him quietly. Look at the margin. Peaceably. It's exactly that same phrase that occurred in verse 21, 22 and 23. This is the spirit of David, but now a mock spirit in Abner. It's not genuine this time. He goes to speak in peace, to him in peace, and he smote him there under the fifth rib, and he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. This was vengeance on the part of Joab. And Joab knew what this man was like. He knew what Abner was like. He'd been around David's company for a long time, and he'd known what this man Abner was like. And there was no doubt he was a crafty, crafty, evil politician. There's no doubt about that. And maybe Abner did deserve to die, brothers and sisters, but he did not deserve to die at the hand of Joab for the reason that Joab took his life. It was a despicable act, outrightly condemned in the law, Deuteronomy 27, verse 24, if you want to make a note of it, Deuteronomy 27, 24, outrightly condemns what Joab actually did here. And you know, brothers and sisters, he didn't care a whit for what was happening in David's negotiations. This had got to a very delicate point in the negotiations of trying to bring unity in the ecclesial world. And the ecclesia had been divided for now, well, it would have been nigh on 12 plus, nearly 7 years. It would have been almost 20 years. The ecclesia had been divided and David had been ousted. And now David's trying to bring this all together, and Joab comes in and wrecks everything under the guise of peace in those delicate negotiations. Just as the key player, Abner, is about to go back to all the other tribes and to convince them now that is the time to come and unify the nation as one again. Can you imagine what that did to David? Can you imagine the spirit of this man and the distress that it brought him? Because David had worked so hard and had waited so patiently for all of this. And now Joab had just stepped in and apparently just wrecked everything that David had actually been trying to achieve. Verse 28, we find David's reaction. You know, and these next few verses, brethren, sisters, tell us a great deal about David, just as many of those other little insights just in the chapter 2 and 3 that we actually had a look at last time. Just look for those insights here in verse 28. And afterward, when David heard it, he said, "I and my kingdom are guiltless before Yahweh forever from the blood of Abner the son of Ner. Let it rest on the head of Joab and on his father's house, and let there not fail from the house of Joab one that hath an issue, or that is a leper, or that leaneth on his staff, or that falleth on the sword, or that lacketh bread." David was utterly distressed, and he totally distanced himself from Joab as guiltless of all that he had done. You know, it may well have appeared to the rest of the nation up north, and as they were scattered all over, sitting patiently just waiting to see what Abner's negotiations would bring with this King David down in Hebron. And they just get word that Abner's been killed in the middle of the negotiations, right in Hebron. So clearly, in their mind, as rumours started going out, it would have been that, it's all off. There's absolutely no trust here. You can't do anything with this man. Well, David probably should have dragged Joab in and taken his life. You know, a little later, just we'll have a look at it in a minute, briefly, David took the lives of those men who killed Ish-bosheth and just murdered him innocently. So why didn't he deal with Joab here? Well, we find at the end of that chapter that he can't deal with him, and he leaves it to God to deal with him. Verse 39, he says, "I am this day weak, though anointed king." Doesn't really mean weak. It means tender-hearted. You know, it's a phrase that's used of Josiah when he responded to God. He was tender-hearted. He could be touched by human experience. He could be touched by God's principles and God's word. And even though he was that day anointed king over Hebron, these sons of Zeruiah are too hard for me. And he says, "And Yahweh shall reward the doer of evil according to his wickedness." You know, it would have actually taken a lot of trauma out of many things that happened in David's life from here on if Joab had been dealt with summarily and executed on that day for this blatant murder of Abner, the captain of the host of Saul. And yet it was not to be so. God's will was that this man was going to occupy a place close to David, though he was not of David's mind. And it's a very interesting insight, brethren and sisters, sometimes to ecclesial life, because God appoints sometimes that we are not always going to be rubbing shoulders with those who are exactly thinking identically to ourselves. And thereby character is formed and forged. And David had the opportunity for that to happen, though it was a very painful experience from here on. And eventually he said to Solomon, "This man needs dealing with." And Solomon dealt with him. But David couldn't. Well, he didn't do nothing here. David's hatred of this act was just incredible. And in verse 31, David said to Joab and all the people, and notice this, notice the repetition from here on till the end of the chapter of all the people. David is concerned about these people, all the people, not because he's got a political agenda and he wants to actually become king. His agenda is, brethren and sisters, the unity of the ecclesia. It's the unity of the nation. He can see the nation's being ripped apart by civil war and by evil men that have gotten in the way. And David is very concerned for all the people, as we find all through here. David said to Joab and all the people that were with him, rend your clothes and gird you with sackcloth and mourn after Abner. And King David himself followed the bier. He proclaimed a public mourning for Abner. And he weeps at that ceremony. You know, you think about this man, brothers and sisters. This is not crocodile tears on the part of David. This is genuine. All the people wept. And they were moved by what they saw David doing there. Verse 32, and they buried Abner in Hebron. The king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner. And all the people wept. You know, this was genuine. And they saw, all the people saw that this was genuine. How could you ever mourn for a man like Abner? Do you think David was mourning because Abner was finally out? Sorry, was weeping tears of joy because Abner was finally out the way? No, not that wasn't what this man was like at all. But you just think what Abner had done to David. He was David's number one enemy, and he had been for the last 15 or 16 years. He'd masterminded the ousting of David out of the country and pushed him away from the temple, pushed him away from his family for year after year after year. He'd masterminded the hatred and division in the nation, and he'd persisted in establishing that even after Saul had died. And now he's killed by Joab. And David is moved to tears over that man. It's the Spirit of Christ himself when he gave an amazingly challenging statement to us in the Sermon on the Mount. He said, love your enemies and do good to them that despitefully use you and persecute you. There's almost no greater example in the Old Testament of that, is there? Here it is. Here's David doing just exactly what Christ said. And he hadn't heard the words of Messiah. He prefigured Messiah. He showed Messiah. This was the way. This was the heart that was in tune with God. He's truly a remarkable individual. Verse 32 tells us he was buried there. He was buried in Hebron. You know, that's we could read straight over that, but just think about what that means. They buried Abner in Hebron. Abner didn't belong in Hebron. His family was not in Hebron. He was from Benjamin, and Hebron was in Judah. Why would David bury him in Hebron? Why not send his bones back to Gibeon or to Mahanaim or somewhere else? Why not do that? Well, I don't think David wanted Abner's bones to become a rallying point for division. But I think there's another reason, and an even more profound reason. Because he buried him in his own royal city, right there with him, it signaled to all the people that David had accepted the good intent and will of this man, and that he was honourable in trying to bring unity in the ecclesia. Now, we know that Abner's motives to start with were anything but honourable. But what an amazing thing it is for David to honour that man by allowing him to be buried in his own city of Hebron. Just amazing. And what was the reaction of the people when they saw all these things? They see the reaction of the king. They see him lamenting over Abner. And verse 36. And all the people took notice of it. And it pleased them. As whatsoever the king did pleased all the people. This man is having a profound effect. He's not trying to go out and impress people, brothers and sisters. He's just being himself. He is a man that's in tune with God and he's reacting according to his own conscience, what's right and wrong. He's just showing how his life has always been lived. And all the people are watching and they're all noticing. And when they saw it, they're being pleased by that. Verse 37, and all the people and all Israel, look at the emphasis on this, understood that day that it was not of the king to slay Abner the son of Er. There was a groundswell that's starting. The nation really hadn't seen anyone in a leadership position in the nation like this man for a long time. And some of them would have remembered David in his youth, but they hadn't seen anyone else like this, and they took notice of it, and it actually pleased them. It attracted men of good and honest heart. But look at verse 38. Look what the king said to his servants. This is now not in front of all the people. It's not out at the graveside. This is now when he's back in his palace. You know what happens, brethren and sisters, when we're back in our palaces, so to speak, when we're actually privately somewhere, where just the people that we're actually having a lot to do with, in this case his servants that he intimately knew, he's just with them now. That's when the true feelings of a person get revealed. Well, look what he says, just privately to his servants. Know you not that there is a prince and a great man fallen this day in Israel? What an amazing man. Could you have ever said that? Of a man that had hunted you as if you were a flea all over the country for years and years and years. He says, there's a prince and a great man fallen today. But you'll notice that David didn't say anything about his moral character. He said he was a great leader. He served the nation. He led the army. He served the king. He sacrificed himself for the nation in his day. And that day that he died, he was doing the best deeds that he'd ever done in his life, because he was working finally for unity in the ecclesia. And David wasn't going to go past that. David wasn't going to go back and start listing all the things that were in his memory about this man. David is just way above us sometimes, brothers and sisters. He puts all that aside and can generously acknowledge the good. He didn't have to go and rake up all the evil. He could have had mountains of stuff to say about Abner that could have put him in the hearts and minds of people to despise him for the rest of their days. But there's not one word of that comes from David's mouth. It's an amazing lesson here, isn't it, in this man? You know, and just as the kingship's just, well, it looks as though it was all, this whole unity arrangement was going to be scuttled as a result of Joab's folly. But fortunately, just the character of the king carried the day, and the rumours went out to the rest of the nation, and all the people were saying, yes, what David did was honourable and good. And they actually started to warm again to David. And right then, you couldn't believe this, we have chapter 4 come in. And two of Ish-bosheth's captains of his band, in verse 2 of chapter 4. And Saul's son had two men that were captains of bands. The name was, well, one was Baana, and the name of the other was Rechab, the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, the children of Benjamin, for it was Rechon and Benjamin. Verse 5, and the sons of Rimmon, Rechab and Baana, went and came about the heat of the day to the house of Ish-bosheth, who lay on his bed at noon. And they came in here into the midst of the house, as though they would have fetched wheat, and they smote him under the fifth rib, and they escaped with his head. You can't believe that another thing is going to get in the way. It's as if it appears on the surface that God is actually not behind all this. Constantly things are just going wrong. It moves forward a bit and then there's another catastrophe. I mean, this reaction of these two, Rechab and Baana, is possibly prompted by Saul's attack on the Gibeonites that we read about later, and we'll come to an incident in David's life later where we read about that happening earlier. But it may have been a payback from that onto the house of Saul here. But it was undoubtedly a horrific and unjustified murder of an innocent and weak man. He was basically defenseless and weak anyway. He'd been left by Abner, and now he really had no strength to prop up the kingdom at all. And yeah, though he was weak and had not at this stage sided with David, this certainly looked like another blow to the advancing unity in the nation. Well, David doesn't move in and do anything to start with, but the assassins come to him and expecting some personal advantage in the kingdom, because they've now removed this mighty king over in Mahanaim, Ish-bosheth, who was just a nobody anyway. And David just reacts. Look what we read about David in verse 9. David answered Rechab and Baana, his brother, "As Yahweh liveth, who hath redeemed my soul out of all adversity." Who was David thinking of there? Where did those words come from? He didn't make them up. Jake, at the end of his life. David's still a young man here. He's in fact only in his 30s. And he says, "And when one told me, saying, 'Behold, Saul is dead,' thinking to have brought good tidings, I took hold of him and slew him in Ziklag, who thought that I would have given him a reward for his tidings." So he's telling me he was very badly misread by this man who came bringing the tidings to him in Ziklag. "How much more," verse 11, "when wicked men have slain a righteous person in his own house upon his bed, shall I not therefore now require the blood of your hand and take you away from the earth?" And that's exactly what he did. He commanded his young men, and they slew them there, and they cut off their hands and their feet. They cut off the hands that were quick to shed innocent blood, and the feet that were swift to run to evil, as Proverbs 6 tells us. David didn't need anyone to help him come to the kingdom in that sense. He was prepared to wait for God's good time and in the circumstances that God would bring about providentially. And we find here David just being him. A man who loved righteousness and hated iniquity. And he moved quickly to show what he felt about that. He didn't do it as a melodramatic action here. It sounds and looks a fairly gruesome thing to hang someone with no feet and hands. But what a powerful lesson that left upon all the nation. You know, there was going to be no respect of persons here. In his kingdom, if he became king over all the nation, there were not going to be people that would come secretly and try and look for favours or do some underhand things to try and curry favour with him and get a hearing from him. Evildoers would be dealt with concisely. And he was always going to be on the side of right. You know, brothers and sisters, that's telling us an enormous amount about this man. And the whole nation is looking on as they see the turbulent events that are just flowing out across the nation after the death of Abner and now the death of Ish-bosheth. And the very next thing we read in chapter 5, verse 1 is, Then came all the tribes of Hebron of Israel to David unto Hebron, and spake, saying, "Behold, we are thy bone and thy flesh. And also in time past, when Saul was king over us, thou wast he that leddest out and brought us in Israel. And Yahweh said unto thee, Thou shalt feed my people Israel, and thou shalt be captain over Israel." So this last event there, this Ish-bosheth's death and David dealing concisely and decisively with those two assassins was the last brick in this landslide of events that now were going to bring the whole of the nation, all the tribes we now find, all the tribes of Israel, come to David. You know, David may have had advice early. We don't know whether he did, but it's highly likely that he had advice from Joab and others to say, well, you've got to take a move now. You've got the tactical advantage. You should go in and move and suppress the nation now. You've been proclaimed by God to be the king. Go and claim the kingship and force the rest of the nation to submit. But such was not David's way, and such was not God's way, because David, being a man after God's own heart, was prepared to wait for God to work. And what actually happened through all this tumultuous experience of those 7 years, brethren and sisters, in time God had prepared the hearts of the nation to come and want to serve David. What an amazing difference that is than if David had gone out and suppressed the people and told them now he was king and that they had to obey everything he did and they were going to do this and that and so on and lay down the law. This is the spirit of Messiah. Now, Messiah, when he comes, brothers and sisters, is no doubt going to destroy the wicked. But it will be a process when people are attracted and drawn and voluntarily turn their hearts to him. You know, compulsion doesn't do anything. It's not honouring to God in the end. And those set of circumstances, as difficult as they were for David to endure, were there to bring the nation to God and to David. What did they see in David? Well, I just made a list. In fact, what I did, brothers and sisters, as we were going through chapter 2, 3, I did exactly what I asked you to do last time. As we were just going through, and as you come across in particular incidents, write down things that this is telling us about David, that the people knew and would spread through the nation. Look at that list. They knew he had generosity and care and support for his people. He had strength of character and integrity and honesty and courage and valour and goodwill and gratitude to others. And he was innocent and upright. He hated evil. He recognised the good in others. He held no past grudges. There was no partiality. There was decisiveness when evil was about. There was no respect of persons. Incredible self-control on his part, but a warm and generous spirit, forgiving, seeking peace, and patiently waiting for God. And when the nation built this picture, slowly built this picture, they were just drawn to this man. They hadn't seen a leader in Israel like that. They certainly didn't see that in Saul. And they certainly didn't see that in most of his men that had surrounded Saul. And they now come, moved by what they'd seen in this man over all these events that were transpiring, to come to make David king. And they give us three reasons. Did you notice what those three reasons are? First one, we're your flesh and bone. We are your brethren after all. We are not enemies. Even though Saul had tried to make David an enemy, we are not. We realise finally that we are brethren. Well, that's a good start, isn't it, brethren and sisters? And your proven leadership in the past, you led out and you brought Israel in the past. Yes, we remember that, David, and that's a reason we're here now. And also, thirdly, Yahweh's already declared it. He has said to you to feed your people Israel and be a captain over Israel. God's already said it. You know, brothers and sisters, all of those reasons that they came to Hebron to make David king were valid 7.5 years before. But it's only now, through all those circumstances, that they've become convicted of this and know this man and want him to be their king. You know, the last reason should have been sufficient, shouldn't it? It should have actually been sufficient. And I find this really fascinating. I just want to spend a little bit of time on this verse for a minute. Because they said, And Yahweh said unto thee, thou shalt feed my people Israel, and shalt be a captain over Israel. Do you know that those words are actually not recorded anywhere? Before this time, interestingly, we find something very similar in 2 Samuel 7, verse 7, that you're probably familiar with. You can just make a note of that if you like, 2 Samuel 7, 7. But it's clearly something that they knew. They could recite this, that this is what Yahweh said, thou shalt feed my people Israel, and thou shalt be a captain over Israel. You know, I think that is highly unlikely that people would have remembered that. And yet, surprisingly, they did. They did remember those exact words and the order in which it has actually been said. And I think that's the most amazing part of this. Because did you notice it doesn't say anything about just being king? It says, thou shalt feed my people first and then be captain over Israel. So they were saying that God had originally said, David, you are first going to feed my people and then you're going to be captain over them. In other words, the role of a shepherd was actually more important than that of being captain. Now, this is quite amazing because we find this little phrase here, this that he's going to feed his people Israel, occurs a few occasions here and in 2 Samuel 7, verse 7, and also in Psalm 78, verse 70, which we'll turn to in just a second. But, you know, when we go back to the early part of David's life, one thing stands out in his early experience. If you care to do it, if you've never done it, in 1 Samuel 16 and 17, if you just get a coloured pencil, you'll find there's this laboured emphasis on David's early experience with sheep and you know, working with sheep, the sheep coat, and things to do with sheep. Seven or eight times in those two chapters that's actually mentioned about David's early life. And then we find that, so let's go to Psalm 78. And you'll be familiar with these words at the end of this psalm, Psalm 78. And this isn't just something of academic interest either, brothers and sisters. Psalm 78, right at the end, and it says, and he chose David, also his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds. Now, the psalmist did not have to say that. He didn't have to mention that he came from the sheepfold. But listen to what he goes on to say. From following the ewes, great with young, he brought him to feed Jacob, his people, and Israel, his inheritance. That was God's intention, first and foremost in appointing David, was that he was going to feed his people. And he taught him what that was going to be like by putting him out with sheep. Let's read on. So, verse 72 says, he fed them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them by the skillfulness of his hands. It says nothing here about his great prowess in war, about his mighty acts as an administrator in the kingdom. It says God looked for a man who would feed his people, number one. And that person, he said, is also going to be captain. So the qualification to be the captain over his people was first that he had to know how to feed his people. So shepherding taught David the character and the care that he needed to come and bring that to his people. And there twice in those few verses at the end of Psalm 78, we find this emphasis on feeding. And yet we know that God had actually selected him as king to follow Saul. But it does tell us very clearly what God is really looking for in a king. You remember that when back in 1 Samuel 13, in verse 14, we won't turn to it now, it says there when Samuel came to anoint, or when Samuel was first told about anointing this, he says, I've looked out for someone after mine own heart who shall be captain over my people. Now you put that together with this. Here, it says that Yahweh had said, I'm going to get someone to feed my people Israel and be captain over them. Now, in both that statement we find back in 1 Samuel 13, verse 14, and here in 2 Samuel 5, we find the issue about captain last. But the parallel is between a man after mine own heart and a shepherd.
feeding his people. That actually is what God was like. God is the predominant shepherd. It's a characteristic of his that he found in this young man, a man after his own heart, was going to be one who would feed his people. And God is the, of course, we know, the supreme shepherd. I'll come back to that in a moment. Is the supreme shepherd. I think it's really, really worth sort of thinking just at the moment about Psalm 23. That was a psalm of David there where he says, Yahweh is my shepherd. And he goes on to talk about him feeding him, providing with water, providing him with nurture and care, and leading him through the difficult times of life. And that's, in fact, what God wanted in a king. It was about, true kingship was about guiding and caring and feeding his people and protecting them. Not about making laws and dictating. It was about serving his people and feeding them so that they might truly be God's people in every sense of the word. You know, when we look, come years later, to our Lord Jesus Christ, and there's a couple of references up here, John chapter 10. You well know what John chapter 10's about, where Jesus actually talks in his first advent what how he came. He came as a shepherd. I am the good shepherd, he said, and I feed my sheep. And they know me, and he was prepared to give his life for the sheep. Not as a conqueror. He wasn't going out there to take great battles and he was there to defend them and to feed them and to care for them. And you know, brothers and sisters, we know what happened when he went off to get rest after the news of John the Baptist, and he gets in with his disciples and he goes across the lake and he gets onto the other side into the remote regions of Decapolis, and they get out of the boat and they see all the people pouring around the lake. And the disciples must have thought, oh no, why did these jolly people go away? And Jesus gets out of that boat absolutely fatigued. And it says, and he had compassion on them because he saw them as sheep having no shepherd. And he ministered all day to them, teaching, healing, and sent them away that night. But when he returns, brothers and sisters, I'd like to come to Ezekiel 34. When Christ comes again in his second advent, to this time take the kingship, he's actually going to come to rule this time, not just be the lowly lamb that was sacrificed. We'll come to Ezekiel 34, verse 23. And there we read, "And I will set up, says God, one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, even my servant David." Well, we know that this is not David. This is the future. This is actually talking about Christ. "Even my servant David, my servant the beloved, the greater than David." But you know, David's name is actually put here because he was the forerunner of this great one. It was in his life that this was first enacted, this spirit of feeding. Read on. "And he shall feed them, and he shall be their shepherd. And I, Yahweh, will be their God, and my servant David, a prince or a king among them." Now notice there, brothers and sisters, those exact two ideas. And when he comes the second time, brothers and sisters, he's still going to have the characteristic of feeding. He's still going to predominantly be a shepherd. And that quality is going to allow him to be the greatest prince in the earth. Because he'll know what people want. He'll know what they need, and he'll know how to bring them to rivers of living water and find the pasture that's not just going to frizzle up before them. He's not going to feed them on all kinds of useless things and take them in a way that's going to be dangerous to them, because he is first a shepherd. Just come over to Revelation, because it doesn't end here. But perhaps this is the last word in Revelation chapter 7. This is the king, the mighty king that God is going to set on his throne. Verse 17. Let's pick up verse 14 says, I said unto him, Sir, thou knowest. He said, These are they which came out of great tribulation, have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. And they're going to be before the throne of God and serve him night and day. And he that sitteth on the throne shall dwell among them. But let's just think about this. So it sounds as though somebody's now ruling on a throne, and the saints are going to all be there. Verse 16, And they shall hunger no more, neither shall they thirst any more, neither shall the sun light on them, nor any heat. For the Lamb which is in the midst of the throne shall feed them and lead them unto living fountains of waters. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. The great prototype for the kingship of Christ himself is built on David as an amazing shepherd, not only of sheep, but of men. And what's that got to do with us, brothers and sisters? Well, we know that every one of us has been called to be a king and a priest and to share that throne in the future age. And, you know, we sometimes might think, and I've thought this many times in the past, brothers and sisters, you know, it's really strange what God is doing. There are not many mighty, not many noble, not many strong, not many great leaders that are ever called to the truth. But God calls people who can learn to be shepherds. They sometimes are insignificant, and no one notices the careful, tending and patient work that they do in the lives of others to care and feed and edify and guide and lead others to Christ patiently and with self-sacrifice. They learn in the process to deny themselves for the sake of others. And it's that class, brothers and sisters, that Christ wants with him in his throne. It's that class because when they get to that time of glory, they are not going to be leaders full of themselves. They are going to know precisely what the world needs, and they're not going to know how to take people there, because they themselves have been led by the great shepherd to the waters of the living waters of life and the pastures that truly sustain. Well, come back to David. I wonder whether the people realized, in fact, what they were saying. They were citing words that they'd heard through Samuel, that he was going to feed his people Israel and be a captain over them. But they were starting to see the qualities of this man. But you know, brothers and sisters, what I think is actually even more amazing in that verse, going back to 2 Samuel 5, verse 2. But that's even the second thing that they'd said. They said, you know, you were the one that led us out and brought us in Israel. Well, that's actually a citation from 1 Samuel 18. When it just turned back a few pages, 1 Samuel 18, when David was actually fighting the battles of Saul, and verse 13, 1 Samuel 18, Saul removed David from him because he was starting to get jealous of him, and he made him a captain over 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people. Same phrase, isn't it? That you were the one that went out and came in. Sounds like, well, you went out to battle and you came back and we're still all here. It was victorious. Verse 16. And all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before them. Now, you know, brothers and sisters, do people actually just love people because they're a great warrior and they go and kill people and fight great battles? Well, okay, yeah, that might be that a lot of chivalry there. Might be, you know, they're prepared to risk their life and people get drawn to that. But, you know, there's this an utterly amazing connection here with that little phrase and the whole concept of David becoming king. Why don't you come back to Numbers chapter 27? Because here, when Moses had finally got to the end of his probation, and he needed another man to lead the nation. As it were, I suppose, like another king in the nation, even though he wasn't a king at that time, a leader that was going to lead the people. Verse 16 says, "Let Yahweh, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation, which may go out before them and which may go in before them." Oh, exactly the same idea. "Which may lead them out and which may bring them in. That the congregation of Yahweh be not as sheep which have no shepherd." So what Moses was doing, look what he says in verse 16. He says to Yahweh, the God of the spirits of all flesh. That is a very unique title. God, Yahweh, the God of the spirits of all flesh. Because what he wanted God to do is calling upon the God that can penetrate the minds and the motives of every man in Israel. And he wants God to search out the man with the right heart, the right spirit, whose heart is just like God's, and him is got it. He wants him to be the man that's going to go out and come in, because Moses saw all that people like a great flock of sheep that needed leading carefully and feeding every day. And that's exactly what God did. He found him one. He found Joshua, and Joshua did it. You know, just out of interest, just you make a note of this and pursue it if you like, but this is not something that stops here. And it's also related to the theme of shepherding. Because in Acts chapter 1, verse 21, when the disciples are trying to decide who they're going to get to replace Judas, they say the conditions are, we've got to find someone who's accompanied about with Jesus, you know, and like in Sunday school, everyone learns, well, you know, they had to have been around Jesus, and that was one of the qualifications, and so they picked two, and then they had a vote on which one it was going to be. You look at that carefully. This is what it says. "Of these men which have accompanied with us all the time, the Lord Jesus went in and out amongst us." That is not just saying he happened to wander around Israel. That is saying what Moses said, what Joshua said, what David had said of David. This is the sign of a very, very great leader who knows exactly what people want. And so they wanted to appoint someone who knew exactly what that man thought. A man that had followed when Jesus had gone in and out and in and out. He'd cared and fed and nurtured and looked after the poor and the weak. They needed a man who'd seen that, if he's going to be one of the apostles. They couldn't just have anyone. They had to have a man who was going to be a shepherd to take over. It's remarkable, isn't it? And when the great apostle to the Gentile comes along, look what it says of him. He was with them, coming in and going out at Jerusalem. Does that just mean he just happened to go in and out of the town? No, the echoes are going right back to Moses and Joshua and David. Quite staggering. And they're all over the place, and I'm sorry we can't pursue those because our time's going. Okay. So let's come back to 2 Samuel chapter 5. Because we find in verse 3 that all the elders of Israel came to the king to Hebron, and King David made a league with them in Hebron before Yahweh, and they anointed him king over Israel. This was his third anointing, and he made a covenant with them, not about taxes and all his demands, a covenant about what he would do for the nation. And what an amazing king he becomes. Just quickly hold your hand there and come across to 1 of Chronicles chapter 12, because here we get a little bit more detail about what happened in 1 of Chronicles chapter 12 and verse, well, first of all, chapter 11, 1 Chronicles 11 and at verse 3, we find that this is the parallel record of the Samuel record there. They came to make him king at the end of that, according to the word of Yahweh by Samuel. Verse 10, "And these are the chief of the mighty men whom David had, who strengthened themselves with him in his kingdom, and all Israel, and with all Israel, to make him king according to the word of Yahweh concerning Israel. Notice the repetition of this phrase, according to the word of Yahweh. It's finally coming to pass. But it's interesting, and I would love to be able to spend a little bit of time on these mighty men, but maybe we'll get a chance at some later stage to do that. It's a study in itself, but it's just absolutely fascinating to read about the positioning of these mighty men that David here comes and who strengthen themselves with him as the kingdom is about to establish. But when you come over to chapter 12, verse 23, we find again this same phrase. And these are the numbers of the bands that came ready armed for war, and it came to David to Hebron to turn the kingdom of Saul to him according to the word of Yahweh. And so we read down there, if you scan your eye down the next, right to the end of that chapter, you find this long list of those where every single tribe is included. If you add up all the numbers of those who came to give themselves and commit themselves to David, it's over 300,000 people. Some are just given as numbers. Others are given as lists of names. They are all ready to give their lives to fight the wars of Yahweh. They're mighty men of valor. You know, that little phrase, mighty men of valor, is exactly the same word in Hebrew as virtuous, as you find in virtuous woman. So it's mighty men of valor. These were not just people who were mighty warriors, though they were that. They've come with a right spirit to commit to this great leader. And there were Levites, there were priests involved in there as well, and they come with a perfect heart in verse 38. All these men of war could keep rank, came with a perfect heart to Hebron to make David king over Israel, and all the rest of Israel were with one heart to make David king. Isn't that an amazing little verse? This total unity that had been welded by the spirit of this man. You know, that could never have been achieved by David just going and conquering all the opposition. This was God at work. And Saul had never been able to achieve that because his heart was not with God. And so we find this spirit of fellowship in verse 39. And there they were with David 3 days, eating and drinking, for their brethren had prepared for them. I think that's a beautiful phrase, that last little one. You know, David didn't actually tell these brethren that they had to prepare. They just did. The spirit of David had infused that nation, and the brethren had actually prepared for all those that had travelled down. And it probably wasn't 300,000, but there was a very big company of people had come. And look what it says. And moreover, they that were nigh them, even unto Issachar and Zebulun and Naphtali, brought bread on asses and camels and mules and so on. They brought abundantly down to help out. Do you know, Issachar and Zebulun and Naphtali are up in their tribal areas, are up in the valley of Jezreel and around Galilee. Now, they'd been so moved that they piled all this stuff onto asses and camels and brought all this stuff down to share with all their brethren. And no wonder, in the end, the last little verse, last part of that verse says, for there was joy in Israel. It's just an amazing thing, isn't it? You know, the last time there was joy that we read of, there was joy in Israel, was when David went out to battle under Saul, and they came back with mighty victories, and the Philistines were routed, and the people were unified and happy to come together and rejoice in all that God had done. They'd seen that God was at work in the nation, and it says the people rejoiced, and it's the same word that we find here, they were joy. And from that time, as soon as David was kicked out of the nation was down in the doldrums for years and years. And now, as soon as this man walks back in and welds the nation by his own personal integrity, his own enthusiasm for God, his own commitment to right and his hatred of evil, the nation themselves find joy again. Joy in Israel. And they're giving. They're abundantly giving of their own selves. They've been influenced by this man. Well, I think, given the time and where I was planning to go, I think we'd better stop there, because perhaps I'll just foreshadow this a little. We'll pick up just a fraction of this at the next class, but I think we're going to have to push over some of this and move in. I was hoping to move into chapter 6 next time as the Ark Sport Design. But chapter 5 lays the foundation, in fact, for what David's going to do. You know, what David does, we read in verse 6 of 2 Samuel 5, is the king and his men went to Jerusalem under the Jebusites, and they go, and verse 7 tells us, nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion. The same is the city of David. And David moved to now establish his kingdom and moved to take Jerusalem, which is quite an amazing thing in its own right. And there's a, if you just have a look at this, perhaps in conclusion, there's this, I've only got this very, very, very briefly, and we could expand this at length and put a lot of quotations to support all this, but what we've got from here is this picture of the future ascent of Christ into Jerusalem, because David first comes with all his mighty men. You know, these mighty men that we read a list of in 1 Chronicles chapter 11 and also later in his reign in 2 Samuel 23, are those who had followed him. Those who had come willingly to David, that were in distress and in debt, bitter of soul, and David had transformed those men. In the company of David, they'd become mighty men. They weren't mighty before. They became men of faith. They became virtuous men. They were drawn from Jews and Gentiles, and they achieved some of the most amazing victories. And now they're named in David's book of the mighty men. You know, we can just translate this straight across to Christ, can't we? Because here, Christ is doing exactly the same. All those who have willingly come to him, distressed and bitter of soul, but the transforming process of being in the company of David. Because that's what happened with David. It happens with Christ. These men eventually became the core of his kingdom, of his administration, his rulers, his priests. Because when they were in the cave and in the wilderness, and when they were out being pursued, they learned to work together, to sacrifice, to feed others, to reach out. And then when David's time came to become king, they are those who he took with him as his mighty men to establish the kingdom. And he comes to Judah and saves the tents of Judah first. He then extends the unity of all Israel and brings it together, just as we know Christ will do. Takes Jerusalem. Restores it to a point of being a great, great place in the world. And the nations respond and bring tribute up. And all of this is just in chapter 5. It's foreshadowing the great work of Christ. And while some nations still resist, because that's what we read about there, the Philistines come up into the valley of Rephaim there, the valley of the giants. They think they're still giants. They're still going to have a go at this king, and decisive victories just wipe them out. And then God is enthroned finally, because it's David's intent, as it will be Christ, to enthrone Yahweh in the earth. And that's where David goes in 2 Samuel chapter 6. I think what we'll do is just leave it there, and we'll pick up the story with David coming and taking Zion and then bringing the ark up, because it was it had been his intent to do that for a long time. As a way of establishing God's kingdom on earth.